Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Giles Brandreth. He's had his fingers in more pies than most of us could hope to eat. A former MP and a minister in John Major's government, he's also written biographies, diaries, novels and stage plays. He has starred in his own West End Review, is a successful broadcaster and accomplished speaker. In his spare time, he set up a teddy bear museum, started the UK Scrabble competition and campaigns for public spaces. Yet, despite all this, he says the motto that has guided him throughout his life is "Don't dabble, focus." Whilst at Oxford, he edited the University magazine, directed the Dramatic Society and was president of the union. A glittering career always seemed likely, yet he acknowledges that the first line of his obituary will be that he was the man who wore silly jumpers on breakfast TV. Does that irk you, Giles Brandreth? Because you're probably right.
I accept it completely. I mean, it is more than 20 years since I last wore a colourful jumper on TV, but people do remember them. And the story is true that when I turned up at the House of Commons wearing a proper, you know, grey suit to look like one of John Major's men, almost the first time I rose to speak in the Commons, John Prescott clocked me, leant forward and muttered, "Woolly jumper." I was thrown, he kept this up, and eventually I had to point out to Mr. Prescott that the joy of a woolly jumper is that you can take it off at will, whereas the blight of a woolly mind is that you're lumbered with it for life. But of course, Mr. Prescott got the last laugh because he became Deputy Prime Minister and is now in the House of Lords, and I am here. But I'm very happy to be here, and I don't mind the woolly jumpers at all. It's just a reminder that, actually, once people see you in a certain light, it's very difficult to shift an image. But I don't mind, and it was fun.
Here you are, sitting today with a sort of very dapper-looking suit and a beautiful shirt. I've even noticed you've got some tremendous socks on. They look very dapper indeed. Are you happy with where you're at right now?
Yes, I think, funnily enough, I've always been happy with where I am on the day. I'm quite good at living in the moment. In a sense, what I try to do is whatever I do at the time, I try to do it properly. So the jumpers began in the 70s and 80s when I was appearing regularly on TV. And I read somewhere that what people recollect of what they see on television is about 83% what they see, the visual. I thought, well, you know, what can I do? And so I began wearing these jumpers. And to be honest, it was commercially very useful. I ended up as the director of a chain of knitting shops around the country. I did knitting books. I appeared in commercials. I appeared in panto. So it was a very profitable line. But I only actually wore them until breakfast. So it was always a costume to me. So when I became an MP, I gave away the jumpers, put on a suit. And whatever I'm doing at the time, I try to do that profoundly and properly.
Right, we've sort of got the jumpers out the way. Let's move on to the more important things then. There will be lots and lots of words from you today, I'm sure, but also lots of words in the pieces that you've chosen. Tell me about the first disc that we're going to listen to.
We're beginning with Noel Coward, who's been part of my life ever since I can remember. Music, I don't think, has entered my soul. My soul, my heart, my brain, my life is full of words. And Noel Coward is a master of the English language. In the 1950s, when I was brought up, I was listening to records like My Fair Lady, Salad Days, and Flanagan and Allen, and particularly Noel Coward. This song, written about 60 or more years ago, seems as relevant to me now as it was when it was first created.
There are bad times just around the corner. There are dark clouds hurtling through the sky. And it's no good whining about a silver lining, for we know from experience that they won't roll by. With a scowl and a frown, we'll keep our peckers down and prepare for depression and doom and dread. We're going to unpack our troubles from our old kit bag and wait until we drop down dead.
That was Noel Coward, and there are bad times just around the corner.
I do recommend, if I may,
yes,
Noel Coward's diaries.
Right.
They are wonderful. I just love reading them. And his constant refrain is, "Rise above it." rise above. And really, nothing ever goes wrong in my life. You know, I'm just the most spoiled person on the planet. But when anything goes slightly wrong, I just say to myself, rise above it as Noel would do.
You say you had a sort of Rupert Bear childhood. That's a great little phrase. Everything was idyllic, was it?
My wife would tell you that I've never left my Rupert Bear childhood. Yes, I had a lovely childhood. I was born in 1948 in Germany, in a British Forces hospital. My father was part of something called the Allied Control Commission. He was in the army, but he was also a lawyer. My mother was a housewife and later a teacher. I had three older sisters and a younger brother, and I had a perfect 1950s childhood.
Your parents married within weeks of meeting each other?
My parents met in the 1930s. My father was a young lawyer. My mother had just come over from Canada. My grandmother was a missionary who rode around India on a donkey with a Bible, and she married an Indian Army officer. And they went to Canada eventually for my mother to go to university. Then they came to London. And my father, in 1937, Christmas 1937, bought the first set of Monopoly sold in this country. Came back to his digs, and the landlady said, well, there's a young Canadian student who's just moved in with her mother on the ground floor. Maybe go and meet them. And my father went, introduced himself, met my mother for the first time. They played Monopoly, and a matter of weeks later, they eloped. They ran away.
Now, you yourself married, maybe not in secret, but you married very, very privately, like your parents. Are you a very sort of private, guarded person, do you think?
We did marry in secret. It was several years before we even told our parents that we were married.
Why was that?
Because it was a private thing. And funnily enough, I am a private person. It's quite amusing.
Now, hold on a second. It was a private thing. Why was it a private thing?
Well, if you're getting married, it's actually about the person you're marrying. It's about the relationship. It's not about, for me, it's not about the party. Because my parents did it that way, I felt able to do it that way, and indeed some of my children got married in that way. And I was very comfortable with the way we got married. I liked it. And the truth is, I think I'm professionally gregarious.
Yes.
But actually, at home, I'm quite quiet. So out there, I'm gregarious, but in here, I'm quite a quiet person.
Tell me what we're going to hear next then, Giles.
We're going to hear, actually, having said I'm quite a quiet person, this is a lively, lovely number. I was born in Germany and came to England in the early 1950s and spoke German. And my parents thought, oh, he's got the gift of languages. And they couldn't, they thought they'd find a German school, but there wasn't one. So they sent me to the French Lycée. I began from the age of seven on my own, going on holiday once or twice a year to stay with families. I was taken at British European Airways. I do remember it. I had a sort of label around me, and I was given to a stewardess. I got out. In fact, it was somewhere in Switzerland, and my parents assumed they were sending me to a French-speaking part of Switzerland, but they weren't. They were sending me to a German-speaking part of Switzerland. I actually had to get out of the aeroplane at Zurich and find the railway station, age seven, to go to this place where I was going on holiday. And maybe the world was different. It was a safer place.
Anyway, this piece of music...
This piece of music is French. It's Chartrenet. Boom!
Le vent dans les bois fait ouh, la bicheuse à bois fait meh, la vaisselle cassée fait fric fric frac, et les pieds mouillés font flic flic flac, mais boum, quand notre cœur fait boum, tout avec lui dit boum, l'oiseau dit boum, c'est l'orage, brrr, boum, l'éclair qui lui fait boum, et le bon Dieu dit boum, dans son fauteuil de nuages.
That was Charles Trenet and Boom. Giles Brandreth, is it true that when you were young you wanted to be a sort of Danny Kaye and then Home Secretary?
I said that when I was interviewed in about 1967 by the Sun newspaper. As I said the words, I knew that in my heart I wanted to be a sort of Laurence Olivier and then Prime Minister. But I was already observing myself from outside,
right.
And I thought, actually, make light of it, don't reveal the truth. As it turns out, I'm me, and I enjoyed being a Lord Commissioner of the Treasury. You can't win them all. I keep a diary, and last year I published extracts from the diary and had to go through it and edit it. And I found it quite a depressing experience, looking back. Don't look back. Don't relive the promise, don't relive the disappointments. Live in the moment.
You say in your diaries, on meeting Jack Straw when you were both just, I think, 21 at university, you note at the end of one day's entry, I wonder which one of us will become Home Secretary first.
Mm. Yes. I mean, in the early days of keeping my diary, I wasn't conscious that I'd ever be publishing
it. Of course.
So it is a kind of confessional.
But high ambition you had as a young man.
Right from the beginning. But I think basically what I've done through all my life is, or certainly the first 30 or 40 years, was trying to fulfil my parents' ambition for me.
Tell me about that.
Essentially, my father went to Oxford in the late 1920s. And when I turned up at Oxford in the late 1960s, I really tried to recreate the Oxford of his time. My father, in the 1920s at Oxford, the things to be were President of the Union, Editor of ISIS, you had to direct the OUDS, the Dramatic Society. These were the things to achieve. I turned up at Oxford and I set about achieving them immediately. And as a consequence of this, I just did it, and I ended up, in fact, while I was still an undergraduate, doing a TV show as a student.
But you didn't absorb then any of the atmosphere of the times. Of course, this was the 60s when it became incredibly, not just sort of fashionable, but required behaviour of people in their late teens and 20s to rebel, to overthrow the standards that their parents had set in place post-war.
Yeah, I was an extraordinary caricature. I mean, I looked like Rex Harrison from My Fair Lady in the 1960s. Others, you know, had the dreadlocks, the curly hair and the dope and all of that. And there I was, like a middle-aged man. I notice only often in retrospect that all my choices for these records, and indeed all my references in my life, are to people, personalities who would have been contemporaneous with my father, not with me.
Let's have your next disc then, Giles Brandreth. What are we going to hear?
I went on from my prep school to a boarding school called Beedale's, where almost as soon as I arrived at the school, I met the person who became my best friend for life, a young actor called Simon Cadell. Later became famous in Heidi High, Hamlet, playing at the National Theatre, a wonderful actor, and I knew, I think, that his father was a theatrical agent. So I honed in on this boy. I was about 14, he was about 12, and together we listened to records of... You can imagine what we were like, aged 12 and 14, doing our impressions of Noel Card, Flanagan and Allen, and we could do the whole of My Fair Lady. We competed as to who was the better Henry Higgins.
I'm very grateful she's a woman. It's so easy to forget. Rather like a habit one can always break. And yet, I've grown accustomed to the trace of something in the air. Accustomed to her face.
Simon Cadell and I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face from My Fair Lady.
What's interesting about Simon Cadell, who was very much my best friend and who died about a dozen years ago now, we were a couple of blokes, you know, we were really obsessed with ourselves, but we talked theatre stories all the time. We loved the theatre, and what was fun for us, we were teenagers, and we would talk about, you know, Sir Ralph and do our Ralph Richardson impressions and all this, and we'd compete as to who could be the better Ralph Richardson. Not knowing that one day, actually, we would know these people. And, in fact, I realise now, thinking about it for this programme, that all my childhood heroes, I found ways of meeting them.
But one of the pieces of advice that people are sometimes given is, you know, never meet your heroes. They don't seem quite as glorious as they were when you were worshipping them from afar.
Oh, that makes them more interesting. When I was an undergraduate at Oxford, I put on a production of Cinderella. I wanted for the first night to have my favourite actor come to perform the prologue, and that was Michael Redgrave. And I invited Michael Redgrave, found his address and Who's Who, wrote to him. And a few days later, I got a telegram from him containing just two words, "Delighted Redgrave." Get the telegram.
And you got a private performance out of him as he was testing the acoustics.
I did
you?
Indeed. Yes. He actually did To Be or Not to Be for me personally, yeah. It was flirtation by Shakespeare, but why not? Anyway, the point of the story is this, that Michael Redgrave was a very nervous person. Before the performance, before he was doing this, he was in the wings, shaking, saying he couldn't do it. His voice had gone, his throat. But I forced him onto the stage, and as he stepped onto the stage, everything changed. The body grew, the lights came into his eyes, they sparkled, and he was golden. And he came off and then crumpled again. And that was fascinating to behold as well. So I like seeing them when they're vulnerable as well as when they're en song.
That was a great phrase you used, flirtation by Shakespeare. You've also written about Frankie Howard doing his damnedest to get you to... Well, I don't know how to put it. Probably you do.
Now that I'm in my 60s myself, I realise what I had when I was in my 20s. I didn't realise it until recently. I thought it was these people, you know, were so delightful to me because I was so brilliant and amusing and intelligent and interesting to be with. No, they liked me because I was young.
Yes.
And it's a wonderful thing to be. I think I took full advantage of being young in some ways. I wasn't young like other people in the 60s were young, but I had the best of being young in the sense that older people took to me because I was young.
But you are also, Giles, to use, you know, it's an overused word now, but it probably suits you quite well. You're quite camp.
Oh, yes. I mean, I don't mind that. It's actually been very, very useful, people thinking that I'm gay. What a wonderful cover.
I'm looking at a picture of you right now. I think that's Judy Garland, isn't it, in The Wizard of Oz. And there you are with your plaits in, little red shoes, a petticoat. You look to be and a full face of makeup. You look to be thoroughly enjoying yourself. You're quite happy to embrace that side of yourself.
I loved that. Kirsty is holding a photograph of me dressed, indeed, as Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz. Mm. And this, I appeared in a show, and we had this as a sort of finale of me, you know, doing my Wizard of Oz moment. And I have to say, I did love wearing the costume. That photograph was taken by Lord Snowden, you know, Brandreth by Snowden. I don't know at the time of taking the photograph which of the two of us was the more excited. We certainly had a fun time.
I'm wondering, does your wife have this propped on the piano in a silver frame, or is that one for the drawer hidden away?
I have to say, if my wife knew that this was happening now, she'd be shredding the photograph, she won't be listening to the programme, etc. But I was happy doing that. I was very, very happy. Very happy.
We're not going to hear Judy Garland now, but tell me what we are going to hear now, Giles Brandreth.
Let's raise the tone. We're going to hear the choir of St Paul's Cathedral singing Dear Lord and Father of Mankind. I was brought up in London, and when I was a little boy, I was in two church choirs, and I was also a server at St Stephen's Church in Gloucester Road. And I was a choir boy, and I loved being a choir boy, particularly in London. We got half a crown for weddings, and very occasionally we got a funeral, and that was worthwhile. 5 shillings.
That was the choir of St Paul's Cathedral singing Dear Lord and Father of Mankind. So being the MP then, you waited a good long while to be an MP.
Yeah.
Is it the case that you waited because your wife said to you, I don't want you getting involved in politics when we have a young family?
Yeah. We, Michelle and I, have many friends who are politicians. And Michelle said, families and politics don't mix. Don't do this until the children are at least teenagers. And the day my youngest daughter became a teenager, I applied to be a Member of Parliament.
Now, you were a whip in John Major's government, and it strikes me that you are somebody who, you know, you quite like to be liked. You are somebody who likes to get on with people. The job of the whip, famously, is to stay in the shadows and twist the arms. How did you get on with that?
Quite the reverse. That's part of the job. But, of course, the more important part of the job is to be liked. Right. I'm much more likely, Kirsty, to persuade you to vote with me on my side if you like me, know me, trust me, love me a little,
right,
than if I'm just some fierce barking person who twists your arm. It was the happiest experience of my life, being a government whip. I loved that job.
And what about those very high-flying political ambitions that you'd had as a very young man? When you got close to politics, when you were in among the nitty-gritty, did you think at some point, yes, you know, I might well be on my way to being Home Secretary?
I probably would have ended up as Secretary of State for the Arts, because that's the way the world wags, if I'd been lucky, if not Minister of State for, you know, hairpins. But in fact, If I hadn't lost my seat in 1997 and we hadn't been going into opposition for many years, I would have still been there. It was the overriding ambition of my life. Not to make a noise, genuinely, but to make a difference.
But that was a case of terrifically bad timing for you, wasn't it? To come in at the sort of fag end of the Tory administration.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. And yet it was fascinating because to see a government in collapse is also interesting. I mean, I loved being an observer. I had a ringside seat. Look, I have no complaints. My life has been one long series of, you know, tomato and Marmite sandwiches. I've always had what I wanted.
But do you think you were a bad MP?
No, I think I was a good MP. I believe I was a good MP. When I lost my seat in 1997, having been a Member of Parliament, in the great Blair clear-out of Conservative MPs, I lost my seat. The people spoke. In my case, they spoke in no uncertain terms. And my wife said to me, listen to the people, Giles. They have spoken. They don't want you. So I decided not to go back into politics.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear now? We're on disc 5, Giles.
Oh, gosh. Well, I love this disc. And this is going to take you into my area of weakness, as I perceive it. This is a number called Warning, Man in Uniform. It's from a show called The Vacquis, which I saw at Godolphin and Latimer School, when my daughter, I've got three children, a boy and two girls, called Bennett, Scythrid and Afra. Why they have such amazing names? Because they're such amazing children. And Afra, my youngest daughter, was in this show, which is why I went to see it. But I just fell in love with the show, and I was bowled over by this particular number.
There should be signals up, there should be flashing lights, there should be red alerts, there should be shorts and nights, there should be helmets worn, there should be raids at dawn. Warning, man in uniform, there should be ramparts built, there should be armor placed, there should be minefields mined, there should be padlock gates, there should be gas masks worn, there should be field maps drawn. Warning, man in uniform.
Warning, man in uniform, from The Vacquis, performed by pupils of Godolphin and Latimer School, and your daughter Afra was part of that production, as you say, Giles Brandreth. Your son has gone on to be a very successful barrister, and yet it seems he might be about to give all that up. He's going to venture onto the stage to do. Is it a bit of stand-up comedy?
I hope he's not going to give it all up. That would be madness. But he has a gift as a stand-up comedian, a raconteur, a storyteller, very, very different from mine. But he is, I have to tell you, sensational. I have a daughter who's a novelist, another daughter who's an economist, a son who's a barrister. And having these beautiful and gifted children obviously makes people wonder about their paternity, but makes people really realise that my wife is a truly remarkable individual.
What about Ben, though? If he's as good as you say, and I have no reason to doubt it, might he not get bitten by the bug and say, yes, Dad, I know I've made you terribly proud with the old barristering stuff, but actually I'm off. I'm up to Edinburgh. It's the whiff of the grease paint and the roar of the crowd.
Well, I say to him, you can do both. And he's got something that I haven't got. He has physical courage.
Right.
He served in the army. He is a very physical person. And I don't have physical courage. I'm aware of that. That is my weakness. I wouldn't be over the top first. I know that. My son would be. Physical courage is important.
Do you think that's one of the things that, well, you say you enjoyed your, it was a relatively short political career, but you say you enjoyed it enormously. But do you think that was one of the things that stopped you from maybe having the courage to rise right to the top of the Conservative Party, was that you lacked, you wrote in your diaries, I shan't be Prime Minister, I missed the boat, too busy faffing about on the quayside?
Oh dear, did I write that? That must have been a bleak day. I think greatness would always have eluded me because I don't have physical courage. I think probably there are days when I think, oh dear, look, all these missed opportunities. You were the golden boy. You had everything when you were a young man. I did have literally, you could not imagine anybody with the advantages that I have had. A middle-class English child born in the middle of the 1950s has it all. So maybe I should indeed have achieved even more. And I think, actually, in terms of politics, I could well have gone on and done more. I don't think necessarily gone, you know, won the ultimate prizes. But I think I could still have been of more service if time hadn't been against me.
But here you are, Giles, you have these sort of hidden shallows, if you will. You know, you write joke books and you write quiz books and you started a Scrabble competition in the Teddy Bear Museum. You know, you've done a lot of things that people think, well, isn't that a bit of a waste for somebody who's as bright as he is?
In some ways, people would say that. Of course, there is a commercial imperative. When I was writing children's books, I was really quite a successful children's writer, yes, and wrote a lot of them.
How many did you write exactly?
Oh, hundreds.
Hundreds, yes.
And of course, with a lot of these superficial things that seems and that are superficial, there was a commercial imperative. Yes, I founded the National Scrabble Championship, but I ended up as a director of Spears Games. I mean, the Teddy Bear Museum in Stratford-upon-Avon is a delightful teddy bear museum, but I've also been selling my teddy bears on the Home Shopping Channel down in Florida. And so there are advantages to it.
For now, tell me about what we're going to hear next.
This is Laurence Olivier speaking a speech from Othello, the speech to the Senate. I saw Olivier perform Othello several times in the early 1960s, and this is him. In fact, this was recorded, I think, while he was still rehearsing for the part of Othello. It's the speech to the Senate, where Othello is explaining to the senators the kind of witchcraft he used in seducing young Desdemona.
She gave me for my pains a world of sighs. She swore in faith. 'Twas strange. 'Twas passing strange. 'Twas pitiful. 'Twas wondrous pitiful. She wished she had not heard it. Yet she wished heaven had made her such a man. She thanked me and bade me, if I had a friend that loved her, I should but teach him how to tell my story, and that would woo her. Upon this hint I spake. She loved me for the dangers I had passed, and I loved her that she did pity them. This only is the witchcraft I have used.
Laurence Olivier giving the speech to the Senate from Othello. Is it right that of your first date, you say in your diary, your first date with Michelle, this is, Michelle was not impressed. All the usual stuff fell flat. Unsatisfactory. Curious. Yes, what you felt you had to win a round. Well, you did have to win a round.
She's quite a challenge, and I'm still trying, you know. 42 years later, here we still are. She has an interesting view of me. She keeps me in my place. She thinks, and she's right, that I'm the world's most spoilt and self-centred person. All of that is true. She feels I've had everything and haven't really appreciated it enough. And she may be right, but that's possibly why one is still questing, wanting more. One's always looking somewhere else. So one should actually enjoy the moment more, which is why I'm loving sitting here.
Do you
looking
think
at you?
That's enough of the flannel. Well, do you think she has?
That's exactly what she was. That's enough of that. Get on with it. God Almighty! Realise how old you are. Realise how young she is. For goodness' sake, pull yourself together, man.
Does she have to put up with quite a lot?
Yes.
Yes.
And she does. And she has. And the compensation is our wonderful children. You know, that is the compensation.
What about your own parents then? What did they make of your success and your very public career? Were they proud?
My father died quite a few years ago. My father had been told by a gypsy fortune teller when he was a teenager that he would die at 71. And he talked a lot about this, and when he was 71, he died. He also died at 71 because he smoked all his life. And he was a wonderful person. And a gentleman of his generation. He was a successful lawyer. He wasn't good with money, but he...
I wondered about that. I noticed often in your diaries in those early days that you talked a lot about money and your father's worries.
Yes.
About money. Did he ever manage to put that behind him?
No. And what is interesting is that I'd completely forgotten that until I reread the diaries. Rereading the diaries for publication was a horrible experience, in fact. And I'd completely blotted out that this had happened. You know, you don't actually remember the truth. And the truth was, and clearly I observed it at the time, that my father, through the 1950s and 1960s, was really very oppressed by money worries. And I would be in the same position myself, I think, were it not for my wife, Michelle, and she sorts out all the financial side of things. So I've avoided that by having a brilliant wife who, a beautiful and brilliant wife, who is also a brilliant manager. My father didn't have that. So my parents were financially pressed all their lives, and my father died with next to nothing.
Time for another disc. What are we going to hear?
Oh, good. As we move into the third hour of the programme... when I lost my seat as an MP, my wife said, do whatever you want to do now. Do all the things you'd hoped to do. And one of the things I'd always wanted to do is I wanted to play Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady. And unfortunately, I think Jonathan Pryce was playing to the National Theatre.
Was he any good?
Oh, he was adequate. He was adequate. And then I thought, well, I don't just want to be in that. I wouldn't mind being in, as well as My Fair Lady, I wouldn't mind doing a bit of Salad Days. And what about a bit of Andrew Lloyd Webber? And then I thought, oh, I could be Judy Garland. And so I created this show called Zip. And we did 100 musicals in 100 minutes. And if we didn't succeed, we gave the audience their money back. And every night during the show, we had a Sondheim moment. And here is Andrew C. Wadsworth, who was our leading man in the show from the start, and Shona White. I heard this time and again, hundreds and hundreds of times. And I think I've never been happier.
Thanks for everything we did.
There's more of love in
everything
me right
that's
now
passed.
Than all the little bits
everything
of love
over.
I've heard
too
before.
None of it was wasted.
None of it was wasted.
All of it will last.
All of it will last.
Everything that's here
and
now.
That was Andrew Wadsworth and Shona White singing With So Little to Be Sure Of from Sondheim's Anyone Can Whistle, as you say, the cast recording of Zip. I'm going to send you away, of course, to the island, all on your own. I mean, you'll have the words, you'll have a little bit of music. How will you fare?
I think I'll fare extremely well, because you're going to equip me with the complete works of Shakespeare,
yes,
with which I'm quite familiar. I shall be learning a number of roles, so that I'm ready when I'm rescued. The ship going back, I know I'll have to work my passage by doing my traditional stuff, you know, on the cruise back. But when I return, I shall be turning up at the National saying, I have now mastered these parts. I know you think I'd be an excellent Polonius, but I could actually do Claudius, and I have learnt it.
Do you think you could be a great actor?
I could be a better actor now. When I was young, I couldn't have done it. And I maybe still don't have... I mean, the great actors have such technical gifts, the precision. But I think there is something fascinating about becoming someone else. I wake up in the morning thinking I would love to be able to play Uncle Vanya.
Do you?
That's if you want to know what I would like to do. I would like to play Uncle Vanya. And so I think maybe now I might be able to play... I mean, I did Malvolio at Edinburgh a couple of years ago and enjoyed it and found it a satisfying thing to do. So I think probably on your desert island, that was my plan.
Right.
To do the great Shakespeare parts, have the repertoire ready, and to have one of the books of the New Testament learnt by heart. So I'd come back from my time on your desert island fully prepared. Yes!
I don't doubt you could manage it. Let's hear your final disc then, Giles. What is it?
My final disc, in a way, takes me right back to the beginning. It's John Reed with the Doyle Carte Company singing from the opera Patience. I'm a huge Gilbert and Sullivan fan. I'm now writing a series of Victorian murder mysteries featuring Oscar Wilde as my detective. At the school where Simon Cadell and I were boys, the founder of the school was an old man called John Badley, born in 1863, and we knew him in the 1960s. He died aged 101, and this lovely old gentleman had been a friend of Oscar Wilde. So I've shaken the hand that shook the hand that wrote The Importance of Being Earnest. And this takes me back to the 50s, when my parents first took me to the Savoy Theatre to see Doyle Carte. I loved Patience. It's the opera that satirises Oscar Wilde and the aesthetic movement.
Then the sentimental passion of a vegetable fashion must excite your languid spleen. An attachment a la Plato for a bashful young potato or a not too French French bean. Though the Philistines may jostle, you will rank as an apostle in the high aesthetic band. If you walk down Piccadilly with a poppy or a lily in your medieval hand. And everyone will say, as you walk your flowery way, he's content with a vegetable love, which would certainly not suit me. Why, what a most particularly pure young man this pure young man must be.
That was John Reed from the Doyle Carte Opera Company and the High Aesthetic Line from Patience by Gilbert and Sullivan. So then, Giles, I'm going to give you, of course, as you know, the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. You're going to make good use of both of them, I gather. What's the other book going to be?
The complete plays of Anton Chekhov, because I fell in love with the theatre, I think, properly, seeing the production of Uncle Vanya with Laurence Olivier and Michael Redgrave. And Chekhov's plays, well, they're just wonderful. So I want to read them and I want to learn them by heart.
It's yours. And the luxury?
The luxury, I'm torn. I've just come back from the Vatican and I came face to face with Michelangelo's Pietà in St. Peter's. It's either going to be Michelangelo's Pietà or a cappuccino machine. So we could toss for that.
I would urge you to take the Michelangelo.
Would you?
I would.
Would you?
Yes.
OK, since it's you, I like to please other people. I'll take the Michelangelo, but my gosh, I shall miss the cappuccino.
All right. And if I had to ask you to just pick one of the 8 discs to save, which one would it be?
Well, as I arrived this morning, it was definitely going to be Laurence Olivier giving the speech to the Senate from Othello. But listening to it again, it's going to have to be my friend, Simon Goodell.
It's yours. Giles Brandreth, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.